Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Brian Mann. He's the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio and also a beat reporter for National Public Radio. And one of the areas he's been following is the opioid crisis. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Grant.
Well, let me just start with some basic questions and we'll drill down from there. But first of all, could you briefly sketch out what you see as the major national trends and significant data points in the opioid epidemic in the past few years nationally?
Sure. I mean, basically what we now know is that in the 1990s, drug companies began marketing prescription opioids, painkillers, much more aggressively, and convinced a lot of people in the medical community that those opioids could be used safely, even for relatively minor pain and relatively minor injuries. And so really, the United States became a place where opioids were everywhere. And slowly, after prescription medications like OxyContin were introduced, people began to realize that, in fact, addiction rates were skyrocketing, that more and more people were dependent on these medications in some pretty scary ways. And as unfortunately, as policymakers and law enforcement and others began to pull back the availability of those prescription drugs, many people who were dependent turned to the street, and they turned to medications like heroin, or I should say just drugs like heroin, and eventually other things like fentanyl. And that sparked an incredibly deadly overdose epidemic. Tens of thousands of people have died through the prescription pills. The Centers for Disease Control say that 200,000 people have died from prescription opioid overdoses since this epidemic began. And, you know, the last few years, we've really seen the death and the overdose rates crest. And fortunately, what we're starting to see is that the community response and the treatment response has been stepping up around the country so that some of the worst of that seems to be ebbing. We seem to be seeing fewer people die, fewer people overdosing. But it's still pretty scary out there. This is still a moment when a lot of families are being hurt really badly. A lot of communities are being overwhelmed by the need for social and medical programs, law enforcement overwhelmed. So we're still definitely trying to figure out how to unwind this crisis.
And so how does that national picture map onto things more locally, the problem in central and upstate New York?
Well, I think that in many ways we look like the nation. I mean, one of the things that's really been interesting about the opioid epidemic is that it really has moved into rural America. It's moved into places like, you know, small towns in upstate New York, in the North Country where I live and work. When I talk to people about, because it entered through this prescription sort of vector, the doctor's offices and the local pharmacy on the corner, you know, this isn't something that was limited to one demographic or one urban area or one racial group. This was really everybody involved. And so you see communities, you know, around Buffalo, communities around Syracuse, you know, areas where overprescribing really opened the door to a terrible crisis. I will say, I mean, I've been covering heroin addiction and opioid addiction for 20 years. And this isn't the first time that rural and urban upstate New York have grappled with these drugs. It's just worse this time, and it's more people, more families. Yeah, in many ways, I do think that sadly our communities mirror what's happening around the country.
And it is both then in terms of understanding the problem, both as a cause of death, but also all the other things that are associated with drug addiction. It sounds like the problem is both opioids themselves and those other more dangerous drugs that they then can lead to, particularly if the supply of the opioid is cut off, the heroin and the fentanyl. It's both those things, it sounds like.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, people talk kind of casually about gateway drugs, and in this case, it really was that. Prescription painkillers really were a gateway. You had lots and lots of people, you know, high school students after a sports injury, you know, moms after a cesarean section, you know, just all through society for a period of time, Big Pharma and the physicians who they were influencing said, we'll give you these medications. They'll help. They'll make your life better. And people believed it, and they used those medications. And as soon as people started to pull back and close off that gateway, what we see is that opioids are shockingly addictive. They literally can rewire the brain. And so what people did, as prices escalated for prescription pills, they started looking for a cheaper, more available alternative. And unfortunately, as the black market filled that need, the black market is a dirty, dangerous place. And so, yeah, lots of things got laced into those medications or into those drugs that have killed people. And that's really spiked the number of fatalities dramatically. I mean, opioids can be a maintenance-level addiction. You can be addicted to pills for a long time, as long as they're pure and you sort of know how to do it. But once you're on the street and fentanyl comes into the mix, and carfentanil and other things, it can just be an instant fatality. It gets very, very dangerous.
And thinking about, again, the national level, what are the major things that have been done recently to try to address the problem? What are the main initiatives?
Well, I'll tell you, Grant, one of the things that really surprised me as I was researching this, and New York is a leading model of this, upstate New York, where we live, is a great example. One of the things that I had not realized was just how important the Affordable Care Act is. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, basically caused this enormous Medicaid expansion. Medicaid is the largest funder of substance abuse treatment in the country. And in many parts of the U.S., before Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid, people just couldn't get these services. And so one of the things when I talk to people about, you know, how are you paying for these recovery programs? How are you getting people help? One of the things they point to, and I know this can be controversial. Some people still think the Affordable Care Act is a bad idea. But one of the things that they point to is they say, look, these people coming into our emergency rooms, if it weren't for Medicaid and expanded Medicaid, we could not get them into treatment. We could not help them. Another thing that's really interesting to me is that there is this really profound shift. I've been covering drug crises for many years and mass incarceration for many years. And remember, in New York State, it used to be the norm that when you had a drug crisis, you tried to jail your way out of it. You tried to lock up enough people that you killed the problem. And it didn't turn out to work very well. We had lots of prisons, but we still had lots of people addicted and lots of people suffering. Well, this time, one of the things that's, I think, a bit hopeful is that you do see communities, including police, including sheriff's departments, saying, we're not going to go that route this time. We are going to use a public health response. We're going to try to get people help and treatment rather than putting tens of thousands of people behind bars for long periods of time. So I think those are interesting things, that there has actually been a slightly more, I don't know, holistic response to trying to help people this time.
I want to come back to an aspect of that a little bit later in our conversation. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Brian Mann, a reporter for National Public Radio and the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio. So drilling down a little bit more specifically, the member of Congress from the Syracuse area, John Katko, he has made the opioid epidemic one of his main priorities. He talks about it a lot. How would you assess the kinds of things he's tried to work on to the extent that you know of them so far?
Well, I haven't followed Katko's involvement in this closely. What I will say, though, and this is interesting to me, is that this is this epidemic is different in the sense that there is a broadly bipartisan push to be more directed in this public health vein. I mean, again, this is a culture when in the past you would have often had the kind of tough on crime debate. You know, some people saying we don't want needle exchanges. We don't want, people using medication support to help people recover, things like Suboxone that have a strong track record of helping people. This time we haven't seen that same kind of Republican-Democratic debate. We haven't seen it become, and especially in the polarized political climate we're in now, I think this is kind of interesting, that this has been a very different, but not that it's always that way. There are occasionally people who will pop up and say, you know, no needle exchanges in my community, or, you know, by offering people medical support, you're just enabling their addiction or something like that. But broadly, what I've seen in this very divided Congress, in this very divided Washington, D.C., is a lot of lawmakers who seem to be really looking for practical support or practical solutions, I should say. And again, Grant, I think one of the reasons for that is that this is an addiction crisis that people can't turn into the other. You can't talk about people in the black neighborhoods. You can't talk about people in the poorer white neighborhoods. You can't sort of otherize these opioid-dependent folks. Instead, you really have to be honest about the fact that it's everywhere. It's in the suburbs. It's in the white high schools. It's, you know, across every demographic, every racial line. And I do think that's opened up a much more interesting conversation about what to do.
And it sounds like from what you're saying then that there is this bipartisan consensus on the harm reduction, which is the public health approach there. Those were the kinds of things that you were ticking off.
Yeah, this is really fascinating to me. I mean, another thing that is really different is that there have been for years a lot of people who've said, look, medication helps, whether it's methadone or Suboxone or the other things that doctors can prescribe to help people in recovery. And there was a real stigma against those. Some of it came from conservatives. I also used to hear it a lot from people in the African-American community. Church leaders in particular would say this is just another form of addiction. This is just another opioid that you're trying to get people hooked on. But the medical community has long said this is, for many, many people in recovery, this is a crucial aid. This is necessary to help people. And I hear across the political and cultural spectrum much more openness to that this time around than in the past. And I think the science supports it. I think the success that we've seen helping some people recover, reducing some of the overdose rates, a lot of that has come down to medications like naloxone and others that have really, you know, gotten people through, you know, very dangerous times.
And is the state of New York as an entity more out in front on doing some of the things that you're suggesting may be the most effective, or where does the state of New York fit with the other states in the country?
Yeah, I think that New York State is doing a pretty progressive job. You know, this is a state that has drug courts in place, drug diversion courts that do try to route people. Remember, addiction often comes with crime, people trying to support their habits, and so it's very easy to channel people to jail and then to prison. And instead, I do think there are efforts to get people to treatment and to help. Certainly the expansion of the Affordable Care Act was something that New York State embraced. The State Health Department has modeled some programs that seem to show some promise. I do think that New York has been out front, certainly compared to states that did not expand the Affordable Care Act, where it is very, very difficult for someone who is opioid dependent to get that help. There are some states and some places. I was just in Ohio. I was in Summit County, Ohio, where they had a really deadly surge of overdoses and deaths over the last couple of years. And they're modeling programs there, Grant, that do seem pretty sophisticated and advanced compared to what we're seeing here. So I don't think New York's on the cutting edge, but we're certainly not in a place like, say, Florida, where it's still pretty tough out there and still pretty wild west in terms of people trying to get help.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Brian Mann about the opioid epidemic. He's the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio, but he's been reporting on opioids for National Public Radio. So, Brian, there's been a lot of attention recently paid to these lawsuits and criminal proceedings against some of the companies that produce opioids. And one company and one set of individuals in particular, Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family, for the marketing and distribution of their products. They've been getting quite a lot of attention. And this is a part of the story that you've been following very closely. So let me just start with a question about what kind of precedents are there out there for these kinds of legal actions on the part of the state against companies and one individual family?
Well, I think that what a lot of people point to, Grant, is the tobacco trials back in the 1990s when states and the federal government pursued big tobacco and said, look, you know, you covered up a lot of science and medical research about the impact that cigarette smoking and chewing tobacco, that those are having on public health. And they were able to extract quite a lot of money from the tobacco industry that eventually at least some of it went to helping with health care, helping to reduce the rates of smoking around the country. And so that's sort of the model that people point to. There is a big difference here. First of all, a lot of these companies involved are much bigger than big tobacco. I mean, we've got companies sort of involved here like Johnson & Johnson. You mentioned Purdue Pharma. They're definitely kind of the poster child for this in the drug pharmaceutical industry. But, you know, name brand mega corporations are involved here that manufactured these prescription opioids, that distributed them, that sold them on your street corner. Companies like Rite Aid, CVS, they are being sued right now for contributing to this. And so some of the biggest companies in America, the biggest name brands in America, are facing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in potential liability. And so there are huge economic questions here. And the one other thing that I would say that I think makes this unique and different is that this time around, the defendants, the people who are facing these very serious accusations in civil and now also in criminal courts, they're part of the healthcare industry. These were people, scientists, physicians, people in the corporate boardrooms who were supposed to be looking after America's health, making people healthier, making them safer. And instead, there is growing evidence and growing accusations that with a profit motive in mind, they instead put hundreds of thousands of Americans in harm's way, deadly harm's way. And I think some of the revelations around that over the last half year, as more documents have come out, as we've learned more about what these drug companies did, some of that stuff is pretty shocking. And so that's been a fascinating part of my job, is to look at these documents as they've come out, internal memos, transcriptions of internal conversations, and some of the cynicism and greed, frankly, some of it is pretty alarming.
And is the ultimate purpose of these lawsuits and these proceedings, is it to win some money and then do something good with that money in the same way that the lawsuits against big tobacco did? Or is it to send a message to these companies and other companies about their future practices? What's the ultimate end game of taking these cases to court?
Yeah, so one of the biggest consolidated federal cases is happening right now out in Ohio, and there's a federal judge there named Dan Polster, and he's been really open about this. In talking to his court, he said, people are dying. There are literally tens of thousands of Americans dying every year. This is a real epidemic. It's a real medical crisis. And he has said, we need to get money to treatment and rehabilitation and recovery programs as rapidly as possible to save lives. Mm. And so that certainly, when you talk to people in the public health community, that's a big deal. They're all saying, look, this is expensive. I mean, when I mentioned that I was out in Ohio looking at this one model community that was trying to help people survive, and a lot of it's being done with, chewing gum and duct tape. They're piecing it together. They're faking it as they go. They don't have any money to pay for these programs. A lot of it's volunteer efforts. It's the United Way shifting its philanthropic efforts. And so everybody's saying we need dollars from these corporations just to keep saving lives. So I think that is the number one issue that people are talking about, is we have to find ways to keep helping opioid-dependent people recover and finding ways to pay for it. Going beyond that, I do think that there is a growing push out there for some kind of accountability. The Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, has begun indicting people, criminal indictments. There was just a conviction of some top executives in Massachusetts in the last couple of weeks who were involved in opioid distribution. So people are starting to face criminal prosecutions here. And when I talk to people who are on the front lines, both caretaking, helping people recover, but also people who are addicted, they're angry. They're furious. They feel cheated and betrayed, and they do not want people in this industry to just walk away. They want them to be held accountable. So there is a practical side to it, and there's also what I would just describe as sort of real heartbreak and real rage.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Brian Mann, a reporter for National Public Radio. So on that accountability question, something I wanted to get your thoughts on, and I'll try to frame it as clearly as I can, but isn't it the case that physicians and other prescribers are, you know, they have the education they have and the certification they have in order to be able to sift through different claims of the makers of these drugs and to pay attention to the research and the accumulated clinical experience. So why is it that we're holding kind of, in a sense, the folks further upstream more accountable for this? Or is there another set of interventions here that are trying to hold physicians and prescribers more accountable as well? I'm just trying to understand that decision to focus at one place as opposed to another.
It's a really good question, and I hear this a lot. And I certainly had that question as well. And I do think, first of all, that there are a lot of doctors now who have lost their licenses or gone to jail. You know, there were pill mills out there, both in doctors' offices and also in pharmacies. A lot of those places are shut down. And, you know, the civil defendants here include companies like CVS and Rite Aid and Walmart that were, you know, pharmacies where pharmacists just kept filling pills and sending them out in some communities beyond any reasonable understanding of who would have needed OxyContin or oxycodone. So there is enough blame, certainly, the governments say to go around. I will say also, though, that one of the things that we've seen in these documents, Grant, is that these drug makers and distributors were really, really sophisticated in the ways that they lobbied doctors to convince them that these medications were safer. They lobbied the drug regulators. They lobbied hospital companies. They lobbied the doctors. They convinced them that patients who were in pain and who were complaining about pain, that was bad customer service. They did an enormous amount of effort to convince them that these medications, these time-release pills, were harder to abuse and much less addictive. I've spoken to physicians who say, look, we get it. We own part of this, but we really did believe what they were telling us, that we could do this and that patients would be okay. And the final thing that I will say that has been – this is one of the more shocking revelations – is that in many cases there's now very strong documentation that once drug companies, drug makers, identified doctors who were actively over-prescribing, giving out way too many of these pills – rather than cutting those doctors off and frankly turning them into, you know, drug enforcement agencies and saying, we think this is a problem doctor, in many cases, drug suppliers kept feeding more and more pills to those very physicians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the big picture here is that, you know, a horrible thing allegedly happened here, that doctors, pharmacists, drug makers that probably started with the best intentions, once there was this profit motive, this greed motive that came into the picture, they just kept making and producing and selling more pills. And the government very specifically says that many of these people turned into drug dealers, just good old-fashioned street corner drug dealers. They may have started out as a legitimate doctor or a legitimate pharmacist, but what's alleged, and now there are a number of these criminal convictions, that they just basically turned into a black market for opioids that went through a pharmacy rather than a street corner dealer.
We just got a couple minutes left, but I want to squeeze a couple questions in here. And one is the one that you just kind of spoke to a little bit. And that is my memory in part on this is that the uptick in opioid prescription use did come to some degree from a correct recognition that pain was being chronically undertreated. You mentioned the drug companies using that argument to try to convince the prescribers. Do you see any danger in where we are now of an overcorrection, that we could return to the days when pain was undertreated? Or maybe I'm wrong about that assumption. Maybe pain was never undertreated.
No, I think this is a really legitimate debate. I think there's a really interesting conversation right now about the possibility of an overcorrection, and that people could who really do have real need for these medications, they might struggle to find them. And I've heard individual cases around the country of that happening, of people who are recovering from a serious surgery or they're dealing with cancer or something, and it's just some physicians are so scared now of repercussions. But I will say that, definitely things got out of hand. These drugs were being handed out. I had this experience where, I had a minor surgery, and I was basically offered as many opioid prescription pills as I wanted. And that wasn't that long ago. So, yeah, I do think there's going to be an ongoing debate about where pain fits in. But I do think people are legitimately and reasonably more aware now that there's real risk. Every time you send somebody out with these prescription opioids, there's a real risk that that could be starting something very harmful.
And then I wanted to ask about you and this story. How did you ever get on this beat? Was it because of the problem in the North Country that you were seeing, and then you got more interested in it, or how did you come to this area of specialty?
My editor at National Public Radio, a woman named Andrea De Leon, and I did a story years ago on heroin addiction and methadone treatment that actually involved a trip down to Syracuse and people from Watertown who were going to Syracuse for treatment. And it was a very powerful experience, a very painful and powerful story about people who were trying to survive opioid addiction. This is many years ago, but when this same editor started trying to improve and grow NPR's coverage of this issue, she reached out to me and said, are you comfortable being part of this team? And, this is an area. My own brother, Rick, passed away from complications from drug addiction after initially becoming addicted through prescription painkillers. And this was something that I had seen in my community with neighbors. And so I felt like it was good work to lean in and be part of trying to tell the story of what happened here and, what some of the solutions might be going forward. So it's been – obviously sometimes this is very painful stuff. You talk to people who've lost their sons. You talk to people who themselves are opioid dependent, and they're in just a deep pain at what they've gone through. But at the same time, getting these stories out does feel like maybe it helps just a little bit.
I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm glad you did lean in. That was Brian Mann. Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.